my definition of success was learning, and learning to me was my currency. And that currency allowed me to have new and different experiences, and new and different felt like far from my past. And the farther I could get, the better I felt geographically, in terms of experiences, saying yes to any job, any opportunity at very young ages. It was like I was consciously and subconsciously trying to create this gap between me, my life, and that past in a way that served me quite well.
Hi, I'm Jubin, operating partner at Kleiner Perkins, and I'm excited that you're tuning into Grit. The goal of this is not for it to be a highlight reel of how successful my guests are, rather a candid exploration of how hard it is, both personally and professionally, to create, build, and scale world-class organizations. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe, leave a review, and make sure to follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter. Thanks. I was just talking to Eric about, he's at like some podcast conference, and Eric, at the end of the show, I thank his studio for producing it. And apparently like a super fan came up, knew that he was doing it. And I was just telling Eric, like, the idea of even a super fan is so odd to me. Like, what a weird thing that this random business podcast has people in parts of the world that give a shit. I imagine that probably exists for you now. Like, I bet you have random super fans because of your story, like all over, that probably come up to you, and it probably still is weird. I don't know. Like, is that a weird feeling?
I don't know if I would describe it as weird. I'm sure it was at one time, but mostly it's nice. Like, occasionally it can be creepy, but mostly it's really kind. And often it's, you realize someone's going out of their way to talk to someone they don't know, to express gratitude for something. And that takes a lot of events in their head that have to happen for that to occur. So mostly I just think it's lovely and incredible and really appreciate it. Every once in a while, it's sort of like jarring. But for the most part, it's pretty cool.
It is cool. I imagine that you think of yourself in the day-to-day of like someone trying to build something. That's your own self-image. Similar to me, like my self-image is like, it's not even a podcast or media person. It's like I think of myself in a very different way. Similar to you, like you're a company builder. You just happen to have such a compelling story that others then view you as something that you probably don't even think of yourself as. So anyway, I think that dissonance is interesting.
Yeah, it is important to appreciate both. And one doesn't make the other irrelevant, right? They're just two ways you might be viewed internally or externally.
When you joined AG1, did you first hear about them on all these different, like on Huberman, on Atiya, on the podcast tour?
No, we didn't even start supporting Huberman's pod. He's been a customer for like 8 years, 8 or 9 years. I'll get the year wrong. He talks about it all the time. But we didn't even become a supporter of his pod. He didn't even have a pod for that long until 2021, which is when I started advising Chris, the founder. So no, I heard about AG1 back when it was called Athletic Greens years prior. My husband is in the venture world, but on the side, he is an ultra endurance athlete. He rode across the Atlantic Ocean in a rowboat. He's rode the Caribbean. He's going to row the Pacific. He's cycling the continent. It's like his hobby in between work. And because of that exposure to the ultra community and kind of a high performance athlete community, I had heard about, again, it was then called Athletic Greens, from him and from his community. And I had tried it and begun to love it as a mom of two young kids, a much simpler, more trusted solution to all the crazy pills and powders I was trying to cobble together to support my systems and be an amateur biohacker. And it worked for me. So I was a serious fan when I got introduced to Chris, the founder and CEO, which happened because he heard me on a podcast.
No kidding.
It was either Pomp or Patrick O'Shaughnessy, one of the two or both. And then he asked a friend of his to make an introduction who he knew had become friendly with me, a guy named Sahil Bloom. And so he says like, hey, Sahil, can you introduce me to Kat? I heard her on a podcast. She was talking about brands and leadership. And I think she could help me as I'm leading the company's next chapter. And so Sahil introduced us 3 years ago in March, and we met. I was taking a break off from operating. Chris said, like, hey, will you just advise me? I'm like, perfect. I'm in an era of my life where I'm doing exactly that. I'm advising founders and companies. And so I became an advisor, very typical setup, and very quickly realized that it was something beyond an advisory relationship. And he pretty quickly was like, come help me build this, as most magic founders do. Come help me build this. Come help me build this. I'm like, no. This is smaller than the companies I've run, even though it was much bigger than I realized as a customer. And I'm not sure if that's what's right. And let's just kind of work with each other in this capacity. And then over a number of months, I just started acting as if I owned the company. I mean, it was very clear. It was so central in my life, nutrition and people's health journey. It had been a big part of my personal investments over a number of years. And the advisory relationship over 6 months moved to the real deal. So I've been president, COO, and board member for 2.5 years almost, but all in 3 years.
For those that don't know, what is the product?
AG1
yes.
is comprehensive and convenient daily nutrition. It is basically this beautiful green powder. We only make one product sold in exclusively in one place, drinkag1.com. And it is this green powder that is so much more than greens. Don't compare it to other powdered fruits and vegetables. It is a full stack multivitamin, pro and prebiotics, digestive enzymes, and yes, powdered superfoods. All in one, best thing you can do for your health in 60 seconds. One scoop, 1 minute, once a day. Most people drink it first thing in the morning in cold water, and you're covering your nutritional bases and providing gut health support. So it's nutrients and gut health in a much more trusted, high quality, and convenient way than the powders and supplement biz of the past.
In some ways, thinking about you joining as the president and COO of AG1, I was thinking like it makes a lot of sense, but in other ways, it actually doesn't make that much sense. Like, you were not that obvious of a choice, but in other ways, you were a super obvious. Do you feel the same way? I felt like there was actually a lot of differences in your background to what I would imagine the criteria of the role would be at Athletic Greens, don't you think?
Well, what I recognize is it's not obvious to many from the outside, but to your point, especially the person who's been on this professional journey I've been on, it's incredibly obvious. So the parts that may be less obvious from the outside, but make it a super clear hand in glove fit in a way, is that, yeah, the part that people think is kind of a disconnect is I ran these massive scaled companies in a more traditional business model, brick and mortar franchising, restaurants, CPG, et cetera, leading focus brands for many years. And then this is D2C, global, never had a headquarters in 14 years, one product, one channel, hyper growth. They look like they couldn't be in any more different worlds than they're in. However, I'd been leading CPG and consumer products through focus brands and the division of global licensing, CPG, and e-commerce for many years as the president of the parent company.
Which owns Cinnabon and others.
Yep. Auntie Anne's, Jamba Juice, Moe's, Southwest Grill. So some fun for you brands, read not healthy, and some pretty good for you brands where you can have a salad, soup, a healthy burrito bowl, or a less healthy burrito. And so the portfolio was quite broad. People know me for Cinnabon because it's such an iconic brand, but I ran the parent company longer than I ran the individual brand, which had far more businesses and breadth of more healthful brands in it. What might not be as obvious is for almost a decade, I've been an angel investor in early stage businesses, about over 60 angel investments. And a good chunk of those are better for you brands, future of industry businesses, SMB tech. So that was running parallel to my focus brands path, which starts to make things make sense when you see I spent multiple years working with founders, appreciating earlier stage businesses and the challenges that they go through, which are part of the non-obvious fit elements to my background, spending time in pure health and wellness. Certainly running a company that owns one of the country's largest smoothie chain put me deep into the consumer trend of health and wellness category. But my personal life and my personal investments tell that story a little more meaningfully. Then I sit on the boards of Milk Bar and Slice. They are both founder-led, founder-CEO brands, both about 10 years old, venture-backed. So, you know, you start to see I have these other elements that put the puzzle pieces together. I'm used to working with founders at various stages from very early seed stage all the way through to growth stage, exposure to venture, either as an investor or as an independent board member, alongside blue chip venture capital investors, and understanding the types of companies and dynamics, that less about it being private equity or venture backed and more about the types of companies that firms will invest in, meaning hypergrowth. And you wouldn't describe focus brands or big mature restaurant franchises as hypergrowth. Like, you're kicking ass if you are eking out 10% year over year comp sales. That's a very different story when you're in the hypergrowth world of tech companies or D2C, and you're talking multiples, not percent of growth year over year. So those were runways or paths that collided in advance of me meeting Chris. So my personal health and wellness journey, the multiple brands I ran, exposure to earlier stage, involvement with growth stage businesses and founder-led businesses that all just helped me respect and appreciate and better work with something like a company like AG1 that is still founder-owned, founder-led. Chris is the founder and CEO. We run the business together. And that's a different dynamic than a big private equity backed multi-brand conglomerate.
That makes total sense. I've heard you describe your youth as a Jerry Springer childhood. Can you double click on that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, first I have to share that for a younger audience who won't even know what that reference is.
Which is sad, by the way.
It's all right. I get it. It's like the Kardashians, but poor. So just like think drama, but not the money, not the resources. Jerry Springer was a host of a talk show that brought guests, often who were lower to middle income, sometimes very low income, navigating life's dramatic twists and turns. And the whole angle of the show was to draw out the drama. And so you had alcoholics, drug addicts, people who didn't know whose father was who. And that's kind of the background. And so it's my joking way. It's my way of making light of some of the things that I navigated as a young person that objectively are not what someone would think of as like an ideal childhood. A lot of alcoholism, drugs, family lived in trailer parks, people who were on the streets, in jail. If the people on both sides of my family, if they did have a job, it was like a good, honest blue collar job. So factories, truckers, things like that. That was my life. And all kinds of drama within it, and cousins on drugs, my father being an extreme alcoholic, which led to us leaving my dad when I was 9 years old. And then my mom left without having a decent paying job or a lot of resources and figured it out, fed us on a food budget of $10 a week for 3 years. I grew up as the father figure in part as a result. And
the oldest of three.
Yeah. And just took on more leadership responsibilities. So again, I can be funny and fun about it, even though there's a lot within it that was quite serious and challenging in the earlier days, in particular for my mom.
When your mom left your dad, where did you live?
We lived in Jacksonville, Florida at the time, but my dad was the only person in both sides of my family to have a fancy job. He was a vice president at an auto imports company and actually had a house. We actually had a car. We looked rich by comparison to my family members. And so for many years, both sides of the family were convincing my mom, like, you're lucky, right? You're so lucky. Like, we all have to deal with the drugs and the alcoholism or the infidelity or the fill in the blank negative impact, but at least you get these nice things. And so she convinced herself of that, but she was what was called a secretary at the time, very entry level job. And so we moved out. She was able to get us a small house. There was no child support. He never paid a dollar of it. And then she moved her way up in her own business. She worked three additional jobs, things like selling wine on the weekends with a wine club and helping other people with their businesses, in addition to being a full-time, like 8 to 5 professional. And she worked her way up at a company called JM Family Enterprises and became a manager running Lexus's Rema Nuth program. And I'm just so proud of her. Like, she worked her way up from within. And so it didn't take long between her working multiple jobs and her own advancement in her main job for her to be able to consistently afford a mortgage and the expenses for three girls.
It's incredible. At what point did you think that your life was not predestined to be in Jacksonville or in that type of life that you grew up in?
From a very young age, I did not feel that the environment around was where I belonged, even before we left my dad. Something about it didn't feel like me. it felt, and I don't want to disparage what other people might have felt was perfectly fine. That was their life in their community. But for me, it did not feel like a fit. That's what I can say from a very young age. I felt like an outlier. And so when we left, when I was 9, it felt like the smartest move we could have possibly made. I mean, my mom came to me and said, we're leaving. At the age of 9, I thought, what took you so long? There was no fear. There was no worry. It was like, yes, get us the F out of here. And I thrived. We thrived, even under difficult circumstances financially, with my mom being on her own until it eventually got better. And I don't know. It's hard to explain. It just didn't feel like me. And my definition of success was learning. Learning to me was my currency. And that currency allowed me to have new and different experiences. And new and different felt like far from my past. And the farther I could get, the better I felt. Geographically, in terms of experiences, saying yes to any job, any opportunity at very young ages. It was like I was consciously and subconsciously trying to create this gap between me, my life, and that past in a way that served me quite well over many years.
When you talk about saying yes to any job and any opportunity, you're not kidding. It is very admirable, the bravery that you have shown throughout your career, just diving into opportunities, really not even knowing what they fully were. And I think that that's a defining feature of your career, probably of your life. When you were 19, you went to be a hostess at Hooters, correct?
17.
Hmm? Were you in high school?
Yeah. I started working in malls when I was 15. That was my first W-2 paying job. Before that, I was off the books cleaning gym equipment and doing things around the neighborhoods. Uh-huh. First jobs were kind of odd jobs. And then my second job was when I was 15, working in malls, selling clothes as a retail associate at a place called The Body Shop, selling women's clothes. And then I was recruited to work at Hooters as a hostess. And so I added to that job. So at one point I had 3 hourly jobs as a teenager in high school. Nights and weekends, obviously. And then once I turned 18 and I was old enough to become a waitress, like, because it's a legal age to serve alcohol, that was a much higher paying job than the others combined. And so I quit the mall gig, I quit cleaning gyms, and just focused on being a Hooters girl. But then that led to being a bartender, and then the cooks needing help and learning how to cook, and then being a shift leader. And so all of a sudden, I moved up in the like Hooters restaurant hierarchy, that then I'm like, oh, if I can work that job, now I have access to more shifts, and more shifts equals more income, and more income equals more independence, and more independence equals more, you know, get it, like fueled, whatever was the journey that I was on. And so by the time I was 19, I had worked every job in that restaurant without even realizing it. It wasn't some aspiration or goal. I was the first person in my family ever to be admitted into college. I was going to the University of North Florida. I was an electrical engineering and computer sciences major, eventually added in psychology of women minor. And I thought I was going to finish that degree, pay my way through school as a waitress and other shifts, and then go to law school. That was the plan. And then when I was 19, on the back of all of this experience that was accidental or opportunistic, the company was growing internationally. And I got a phone call from my manager who said the corporate office called and they wanted a recommendation of a top employee who could join the training team to travel around the world and help launch the first of the Hooters franchises on each continent in different areas. And just so happened, Australia was up on the list, and this manager called me and she said, so I'm nominating you. Would you like to go to Australia? And it was some crazy amount, silly, short amount of time, like in 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and not the most organized process. I had never been on a plane. I did not have a passport. I had only been out of the state of Florida a few times in my life for like sports competitions and girls' trips across the border to Georgia. But I said, yes, yes, I will go. Put me on the team. Then I did a little research, booked my first ever flight, flew to Miami, stood in line with my paperwork to get my passport expedited at the Miami Passport Agency, then took my second flight back home to Jacksonville, and now I could legally exit the country. So I said yes before I could even legally exit the country, got my passport, and then several weeks later left for Sydney, Australia. and stayed there for just under 40 days with a team of other people just like me who were brought over from different states to help launch the franchise. You need people who know the job to train new hires in the new country with a new franchisee. And it really did change my life. I mean, one, to have my first real flight be international and be in Australia, I was 19. I mean, it was just, it blew my mind. I had amazing experiences there. It was, we worked hard, we played hard. It was rad. But I got on the plane home and thought two things. One, I bought a bunch of business magazines in the airport because I just wanted to learn more about anything I could around the business side of this operation that I was used to working in. And I thought, who would ever give a girl like me a chance like that again? Like, this is a super fluke. I just got lucky AF. And then a few months later, got another phone call. Hey, we're launching the franchise in Central America. We'd like you to go down and be a part of the team and do it all over again, but different team, different franchise, different country. I'm like, yes, of course. Why would I not do that? I also spoke enough Spanish to be dangerous, which was helpful. And so I went to Mexico and we launched the first Central American Hooters in Zona Rosa in Mexico City and learned a ton there. And fast forward, this kept happening over a number of quarters until very quickly after three or four openings, I was now asked to lead the team. So I'm now going earlier for longer, selecting the teams, preparing them, getting the supply chain set up with the franchisee when I get there, making sure construction is completed when I get there, and then preparing for the training teams that would arrive, which are the people who are like the role I had just been in 6 months prior. And then I needed to lead them to train the staff and get the restaurant totally open, successfully open, and then leave and go do that again. I did that a few more times. Now you play out the years, the math. I'm turning 20. I'm also failing college because I'm never there. So I dropped out when I was 20. A few months later, I get offered to interview for a corporate job in Atlanta in the corporate office. So I put on a suit from the Express, went into the kitchen of the Jacksonville Landing Hooters, said hi to the cooks. They thought it was really funny that I was in a suit and not orange shirts or a manager's polo, and went into the tiny little manager's office and got on the phone and did my interview. And I was then asked to come in for a second interview. So I drove to Atlanta, which was very scary to drive on 7585. And was offered the job. And a few weeks later, I packed up and rented a U-Haul. And I wasn't even old enough to, I think I had to get either lied or get have somebody who's 21 sign on the thing and get my U-Haul and drive to Atlanta. And that began almost a decade-long corporate career with Hooters internationally. I was 20 when I took my corporate job. I was 26 when I became vice president, one of the vice presidents of that company. I stayed in that executive role for 5 years. And that was kind of the Hooters journey. And crazy stuff happened on that journey. We owned and operated an airline. Terrible idea. We were fully vertically integrated. Interesting, but not always a smart idea. So I was exposed at such a young age to so many industries because we owned half of our supply chain. And whether or not people thought Hooters was a sophisticated or great place to work, it was still a brand. By the time I became vice president doing $800 million in annual revenue. So it was nothing to turn up your nose at from a scale perspective. What you could not deny, what I was very aware of, is how unique it was and how fortunate I was to be exposed to all these verticals, all these industries, leading them, influencing them, participating in them, basically as a child, like at a very young age. And because the company didn't have Wharton MBAs beating down the door to become executives, people like me, internal team members, got a disproportionate amount of opportunity. And I took it, and I took every opportunity that I had and stayed there until we finally sold the company into private equity. And then that's when I moved into Focus Brands, which was a private equity owned restaurant and franchise conglomerate.
How old were you when ultimately Hooters got sold and you left?
I was 29 when I actually went back to school. So I have an MBA, I have a master's without a bachelor's. It's rare, but possible. And while I was in class taking these courses, I had a meeting 1 week and we were told by a judge who was running the probate process for the CEO who had passed away suddenly. So I had also had all this experience of a privately held company with the majority owner, president, CEO, chairman of the board. He was basically a walking conflict of interest. He just passed away suddenly. And when you have that much oversight and ownership of a company and you cease to exist, it's a mess. And there wasn't great estate planning. So his son stepped in I ended up being a heavy contributor to navigating that transition as a seasoned executive in the company. And the judge called one day, again, this is while I'm in business school, so I know enough to be dangerous about these things, and said, we are forcing you to liquidate the most valuable asset in the estate, which is your company, because they couldn't figure out how to settle the estate. So the judge just forced it. And that meant we had to sell ourselves. We had to sell our company. You know, for a company that's been privately held at that point, I think it was around 30, 31 years, that's like a bomb of a piece of news. And they may not have loved the ownership structure before, but what you love less if you're a franchisee is the unknown. And this was a whopper of an unknown sandwich coming their way. So I helped lead the process of diligence, working with the analysts and brokerage firms that were brokering the deal. And it was just wild because I would go to class nights and weekends and learn about certain concepts from a legal or enterprise valuation perspective, and then go into a meeting on Monday and think, thank goodness I paid attention in class, because I know this business inside and out operationally. But if I had not gone to that class Friday night, I wouldn't have understood what that analyst was asking me about, because the language is just different. And so the timing was fortuitous, where I could step into a role that you would have never put me in with my experience on paper.
It's incredible.
But in terms of advocating for the company, articulating its value, and helping the key stakeholders in the business be brought along in the process in a way that was as positive and healthy as possible, I was the obvious person on the inside. And through that process, I continued with my MBA, but I also ended up participating in a pretty intense set of management presentations to multiple PE firms. I don't remember the number. It was something crazy, 12, 14, 16. It was 2 weeks of insanity, like back to back, you know, management presentations on the company and the process and the defensibility and the risks. And then after that, I ended up getting recruited by several of those PE firms. And one of them, who had initially recruited me to be a part of the private equity firm, but then because I couldn't come at the time that was needed because the company was in such turmoil, came back and said, hey, we'd still love to potentially work together, because I'd gone through this whole hiring process. And this was Rourke Capital, the Atlanta-based PE firm, in its much earlier stages than it is now. They said, you've said you can't join the firm and we need this role that you've been interviewing for now. We think you should interview for a role we have coming up, which is the president of Cinnabon, one of our portcos. That's a part of the Focus Brands portfolio. And I was like, I would never get that job. Like the type of people, there were CEOs of other large global being interviewed. Mm-hmm. I thought, why would I not go through this process? There is literally no risk. I'm definitely not getting this role. So I went to the CEO of Hooters at the time, the son of the one that had passed away, Kobe Brooks. And I said, hey, I'm probably not going to get this job, but I love Rourke. I've loved getting to know them through the industry. And I think I'm crazy not to at least go through the process. And I just want you to know. And he's like, thank you. I don't want you to tell anyone else in the company because I don't want to spook them at an already tumultuous time, and keep me posted. So I interviewed, I get offered the job. I go back to Kobe. Guess what? I was wrong. They offered me the role. This was April or May of 2010. And Kobe said, you said you wouldn't leave because we're going through this process. We were deep in the final stages of bidding and final PE firms at the table. There were two, it was pretty hot and heavy. And I said, I will commit. I will not leave you in a lurch. I will stay until we had a signed offer. And I am the co-signator on the first signed offer. There would later be other things that happened on a Friday. And I started at Focus Brands as president of Cinnabon that next Monday, 6 months later.
What a crazy story. And what was the state of Cinnabon when you joined?
It was bad. I mean, the brand was beloved, still is, nostalgic, iconic. But this is 2010. It's kind of the back piece of the global recession. The business was based in malls and airports. There are two things people stop doing with depressed discretionary income. They stop shopping and traveling as much. So there were 3 years of double-digit revenue declines, which is painful for any business, but immensely painful for small business owners that own one or two shops, many of them new to the brand, most of them ill-equipped to navigate such a compression of revenue and a hit on profitability. They had multi-year or in some cases, multi-decade leases to large mall developers who were not in the position to be overly flexible or friendly. Not to mention there was a lending crisis at the time, if anyone has read the history books or has lived through this. So our franchisees, even if they wanted to get money and were great, a great investment as an entrepreneur, the last person you're going to lend money to in 2010 is a first-time franchisee of a franchise famous for a cinnamon roll the size of your face at the height of the Atkins craze, which is like, imagine the history of keto paleo. Like that's what Atkins was. And in a retail pinch, the hits just keep coming of what would make you the least interesting candidate to lend money to. And so I inherited a business in decline, a body of franchisees, many of which were in great financial peril, with an uncertain future and a brand that was beloved, but a business that had not innovated in the years prior, which made the pain worse as it navigated tough times. So that was the state of the business when I happily joined.
When you joined, the stark realization of the reality of the state of the company and the job in front of you, I guess, became clear. Were you kicking yourself at all? Like, did I over-rotate or over-index on scope of responsibility and role when, you know, you left a great job that was continuing to rise with a brand that kept getting bigger and better? Did you ever question the decision that you felt like maybe you over-indexed on the job and under-indexed on the actual day-to-day of the work? Does that make sense?
Never. Not even for a second. I mean, a few things were true. One, my time had come to an end at Hooters. I was there for 14 years. Like, I was done. I knew my whole story wouldn't be Hooters. I didn't want to be the CEO of Hooters. I didn't want another decade at Hooters. It was such a magical time, and it was done. I was done. So I definitely never second-guessed the move away. Then the second part, or a part of your question, is then did I second-guess the move, what I moved to? And still, no. Mm. There's something really powerful about inheriting a bad situation, which is, while I guess things could always be worse, it certainly looks like there's more opportunity for up than further down. And all I saw was the opportunity. I loved the brand. I grew up working in malls, as I shared. I mean, I smelled Cinnabon my whole childhood. Like, it, I was truly a fan. And so it had going for it what is the hard part: brand, awareness, consumer trust, and actual differentiation of the product. That is what every business begs for. Business models, economics, leading change. For me, I don't want to say easy, because it's all got a level of complication and requires a lot of other people to come along, but it's so doable and you can do it fairly quickly. But building a brand, an iconic brand, cannot do quickly. So I just viewed it as this gift, this like beloved brand with a broken business model at a time when everyone is having a hard time in the venue and bad times don't last forever. Traffic's going to come back. Things are going to happen. We better get our stuff together, fix elements of the delayed innovation, the delayed investment in the delayed CapEx in the business, and get it more modern, get the menu more modern, get the locations more modern. That would prove to be much harder than I would have thought. I had a little bit of naivete working for me as well. And like, it's only up from here. And the things that turned around the business, and we did fantastically, were not the things that I expected, actually. Like the obvious stuff, the updating the facilities and innovating the menu, it all helped. But the real breakout answers came from mining the insights in the business over a number of months. Like, I could not have had the plan. I could not have had the answer. I had to get in to the business and get it stable, benefiting from some of the product innovation and location innovation, even form a business model format changes we made. We shrunk it so we could accelerate unit growth and added smaller portions and updated the look and the logo and did a few things that all concurrent, which is a lot for a brand that's just been through a recession to navigate, certainly franchisees, but we did it. We figured out how to do it. But the things I'm known for, the things that would become the future of my interests, my personal investments, and my career, were the multi-channel innovations, the innovation divisions, launching CPG products in grocery, launching e-commerce, self-manufactured product and alternative channel. So it was like, stabilize the core, get it back to this place of beloved prominence in its venue, alter the business model so that it can have unit growth more quickly coming out of a tough time, modify the menu, protect what's legacy, but modify the menu so you get more trial, more repeat, sort of a different performance on the check, and fuel revenue and profitability for the franchisees. That was all blocking and tackling. And it was so bad that it wasn't difficult. It was complex to do, but the answers weren't rocket science. But it was the accelerating the seedling business that was licensing and CPG that really put the brand and certainly that era of my career on a lot of people's radar. I mean, we ended up building a multi-billion dollar business off of branded SKUs and CPG in a number of years. And the franchise business was a fraction of that after 30 years. So they actually fed each other. And so much so that that approach, this omni-channel, take a restaurant brand and put versions of that product in grocery stores, which is now like totally the thing to do. Back then, it was quite novel and difficult to do at scale. We built a team to do just that for all the brands. It was our new layer of go-to-market. It was how we would evaluate brands. It added an ability for us to be a preferred acquirer because we had more ways to build a brand than just like, you know, we're going to run the brick and mortar better than you. Now we had that plus our international chops. We were in with Cinnabon. I mean, you add up Cinnabon, Auntie Anne's, Jamba Juice. We were in 70 countries. So we had a real international muscle. And then we had built this omni-channel retail CPG muscle and done it well and successfully and very profitably.
And when you talk about getting into the guts of the business when you joined, does that mean going to the franchise, right, where every Cinnabon in these malls is owned by?
Not all, but most.
Most. And so when you say going in and getting into the guts to actually understand what you needed to do, did that come in the form of going to these franchisees and seeing what the hell's going on internally?
Oh, yeah. Rolling cinnamon rolls, taking out the trash, working the register, closing the locations, opening the locations. I did nothing but that for my first 60 days. I mean, I fired a few people. I had to be in some meetings with the attorneys and at such a tough time, but most of my time was spent in what we call bakeries. So airports, malls, travel centers, like everywhere where the locations were, just in the business, talking to customers, employees, franchisees, stakeholders, vendors, asking everybody the same three questions, finding the patterns out of those, acting on those insights. Yeah.
What were those three questions?
The high level version of them, although this is not the verbatim way I ask them in this situation, I ask the questions differently to optimize the answer of the person I'm asking. But the questions are basically, what's one thing we should stop doing? What's one thing we should start doing? And tell me one thing you would do differently to make the business better. Stop, start, different to make the business better. The way I asked those questions, in order to minimize the wild answers that you can get and get to more actionable patterns, was for the what's one thing we should stop doing, which is the first question to always ask, not the last, the first. I needed to find my own pennies in the P&L. And the only way you find pennies is you stop doing stuff. You stop paying people for things, you remove roles, you stop producing things, you cut in order to open up capacity, and then you reinvest that capacity. So I asked things like, what do we make you do that you don't use? What do we make you produce that doesn't add value? What do you make that you see customers throw away? I'm asking the very specific evidence question that there is something that we are currently investing resources on that the intended stakeholder does not fully value. They don't use it. They throw it away if we make them take it. So those are things that if I stopped doing by those answers, people are not going to care and they might even applaud. So I'm stopping it. I'm not paying for the training manual anymore that no one uses. Some of the feedback I got was we see people throwing away portions of the large cinnamon roll more and more as years go on. So I wanted what we should stop doing. But the way I asked is asking a more specific question that would give me the actual list of things that I could then make a big list of, look for patterns, and the top few things, we just cut it, right? Just stop. The next question, which is, what should we start doing? The way I ask that question is, when do we say no to customers? A lot, consistently. And I'd ask that question in Poughkeepsie, in an airport. I ask that question in Kansas City, in a mall, in LA, in a mall. And I kept hearing the same answers, a pattern. When do you say no to customers? When they ask for smaller portions. Everybody. There's a little bit of people wish we had better coffee because Starbucks was growing in malls at the time and it was creating a new competitive dynamic. But mostly it was small portions. So here I've got people saying, we see customers throwing away more of the big cinnamon roll than they used to. Oh, we say no most often when people ask us for smaller portions. Maybe we should launch a smaller portion. That might be a good idea, but that's not enough. So then tell me one thing you would do differently if you were me. And the answer to this question, of course, varies more broadly. It's a bit less specific and certainly will lean a certain way depending on if it's a franchisee or a manager or a customer or a team member. But the franchisees were like, we need to make more money. Like, you need to help us make more money. We're losing money. Their sales are down. Traffic's down. It's hard time. We keep raising prices, which is a dangerous path for a small business to take with decreased transactions, but understandable because they're scared and they're trying to keep their revenues high. But they were talking profitability, right? Not even top line, just profitability. And the team members were like, you know, it's a mall and people are busier now and they're carrying more bags and there's a Starbucks and we need more portable products. And so the themes I got from that question were portability and profitability, which, if you connect to the answers to the other questions, smaller portions, fit perfectly. So those insights ended up launching an initiative to grow a product called the Mini Bon, which actually some franchisees were selling in small pockets, but most franchisees refused to sell because they thought it would create trade down and diminish the trade up that they were getting from a larger purchase. And quite an interesting time. But those are the questions. One thing to stop doing, one thing to start doing, one thing you do differently if you were me. But you have to ask the question in a way that helps you get the answers that are actionable.
And going down that rabbit hole, once you came to the conclusion through this kind of questioning format of where the patterns existed on ways to make the business better, you decide on doing a kind of new form factor and delivery mechanism for the cinnamon rolls, which was smaller. Can you talk through kind of the execution path? I guess it was circuitous from what I understand.
Well, as I mentioned, there were franchisees who had been selling it for quite some time, but it was not an approved item by the corporate office.
Which is what? A smaller cinnamon roll?
Yeah. Instead of being the size of your face, it's the size of your fist. Not tiny, just smaller, right? It's mini by comparison, hence the name Mini Bon. 300 calories instead of 880, 250 instead of $6 or $5, right? So you get the point. It's portable. It's actually ounce for ounce, it was more profitable. It was portable because it's smaller. So it just checked every single box. But there were many franchisees who said, if you make us sell this, we will sue you because we are already afraid. We are already having revenue declines. Do not make us offer a cheaper thing and give people yet another reason to spend less. The problem is, if you understand behavioral economics, you know that is not what happens when you offer a lower price point entry. You get more trial, you get more repeat, people add things on, right? But those franchisees were operating from a place of fear, of understandable fear. So it was my job, yes, to bring data and insights, but data and insights only carry you so far when you're navigating a high emotion dynamic. And so I leaned on the few franchisees who were already selling the Mini Bon, who had profitability, who had success, to help tell the story. And then we put a program around it and marketing around it and let them lead in the system. So brought the data and insights, but more importantly, let their peers lead and share how this was not some big risk that you're going to make this different product and then you're going to have waste. And then the few people who do buy it are going to be the $5 people who've now traded down to $250, that it's a very different purchasing behavior and customer journey and exactly what you need when you are in a recession in a mall. Furthermore, would be exactly what they would need when the recession's over and traffic comes back. And now it's a new world with a lot of smaller snack concepts and people wanting to indulge a little more responsibly, yet still indulge. And so it was quite circuitous. And the path of navigating the resistors was first confronting reality, making sure they understood that if they did nothing different or something materially different, that they were going to continue on this downward trajectory they were on. And you're asking me for help. You're asking me to help you make money. All the arrows are pointing here. And some of your peers are making more money because they do a version of this. This isn't my crazy idea. This is the understanding of what customers are looking for, what the market requires, and what some of the productive rebels in the company are already doing on their own. So confront reality. Next, find the coalition of the willing, those rebel franchisees that were already doing their own thing, even though it wasn't approved by the company. And then let the people who are doing the work sell the work. So it doesn't need to come from the corporate office. It needs to come from the franchisees who are like, hey, team, this is not the answer, but it's a big part of an answer. And the opportunity cost is too high not to do it. And then very quickly, you get this snowball of participants and you get people to participate with this idea of commitment instead of compliance. I could have forced them all to sell the Minibond in 30 days if I wanted to. Here's the recipe. You're in default if you don't. We need to market it nationally, sell it. But that's not the way to build a relationship with a franchisee who I'm in a 20-year business marriage with. You have to lean toward commitment. And so there's a way to do these things that still has speed, but is stickier and is more self-system driven. And then once we hit a tipping point, I mandated it, right, for the last people, and they had to get on the bus or get off the bus. And that helped bring the Minibond into existence at scale. That was a big part of the helpful revenue turnaround as traffic started to come back in malls and airports.
You then get promoted to ultimately the president of the private equity firm.
President of the parent company.
Of the parent company, exactly. Before you go to Athletic Greens, you have this quote that I've read somewhere that says, anxiety about uncertainty is our human preservation muscle. I thought it was really interesting. Could you maybe explain that?
Yeah. For me, like when people have asked about fear, do you have a fear? My fear for a long time, again, I'm sure it's rooted in my upbringing, is not knowing the truth, the true truth. Like I want to know the real truth, the hard truth, the actual truth, like what customers actually think, what team members actually think. Because if I know that, I can make smarter decisions. And if I don't, I can't. And so I have spent a lifetime, a career of truth seeking in my own business and building teams that can do the same so that we make the smartest decisions. And as you get bigger and you have success, you know, innovator's dilemma, you end up talking to yourself instead of really being rooted in what's going on in the market today. And that is increasingly important as the world moves faster. It moved slower then. But even if I know the answer from yesterday, it's more important to just repeat the question in a few weeks because something could be very, very different. So the questions are far more important than the answers. And so I developed this question asking muscle. And there is a way to productively use this idea of uncertainty or fear of not knowing the truth or anxiety around the unknown or whatever you want to describe it. Like use it as fuel to find the things that are relevant to your business. And just because it's relevant doesn't mean it should be acted on right away, but that's the first step. Like, doesn't even matter to us. And if it does matter, to what degree, and is something around that relevant fact set actionable? And if so, when and how? And then the final question from a leadership perspective is, who can do that? Do we have it or do we not? And then rinse, wash, repeat. And there's something about that feel. Again, you have to have a healthy mindset around it. I'm sure some people could hear that and go, well, fear's not good. Anxiety's not good. The world's already stressed. I'm not saying the unhealthy version. There's a healthy version of believing you never really know what's going on. And you never really know the true truth because things change so quickly. And even if you did know, you don't know now. And the belief might be reaffirmed, you know, with modern question asking. But this muscle of just ask, answer, act over and over in a healthy way, at a healthy cadence that a business and a team can respond and rally around or drive just is a superpower. It's an absolute superpower. So I think this belief that things are unknown, that creates energy, there's a way to use that energy as not something fearful or paralyzing, which it can be for many, and instead use it as simply the juice for the work to be done, for the job to be done, of the moment or of the team or of the company.
This may be folklore, but when you interview people in your office, have you put like a wad of paper on the floor? Is that a thing?
I am now running a company that has not had an office in 14 years, so no way to do that. But yes, there was a time when I was in offices or in physical locations where I would be curious to see people's level of conscientiousness and would either intentionally place something out of order or do something that would create the opportunity for them to demonstrate behavior or not tidy something up intentionally in order to just see if it showed up on their radar. And it's important. People are probably like, that's not fair. They're set up for the trap. I would never use it as a go, no-go decision on talent. It was more if I'm getting to the point where I'm really trying to understand, it's an input. It's an input. But it wasn't this like, if they don't pass Kat's paper test, then they're not getting on the job. But yes, there was a point in time where that was part of my process.
I kind of love it. My old boss used to do this thing where he would kind of lean back in his chair and put his arms behind his head and become very casual just to see if others in the interview process would reflect or mimic his behavior. Number one, because I think he wanted to see if they had an independence of behavior from his behavior. But number two, it's an intense job. He doesn't want them to, you know, lean back in his chair. Kind of reminded me of that.
Well, that's even trickier because I could also see a world in which, depending on the role, if it were a BD like business development or sales, you would want to see evidence that someone can mirror and all of that. So
speaking of kind of the wad of paper, do you have any favorite interview questions? Like, you have hired so many people in so many different types of jobs everywhere across all different levels. Do you have any favorites, or how do you approach interviews in general with folks?
It really depends on the level and the stage of the interview process. You know, in my level now, if they're getting to me, they've been through multiple layers.
Yeah, let's say it's an executive reporting to you.
If they're reporting to me, one, they've still been through multiple layers of interview process before they get to me, or before they get to me in a deeper dive way. I might do an initial conversation, but then they're going through bar raiser interviews, key stakeholder interviews. So it does depend, but you've isolated the example of someone who reports to me. Again, it still really depends on what I'm pushing on. If it gets to the point where someone has made it through those filters, I'm pretty sure about several aspects of their technical chops. So maybe I'm asking questions that further mine an area of their expertise that I want to understand. But more important, my questions will be around culture and how they've reacted in certain moments. Certainly if it's with AG1, which is a very modern company in a modern construct, again, fully remote, never had a headquarters in 14 years, has been hyper growth, D2C, like e-commerce only. If someone is a candidate that comes from less look-alike businesses or industries, but for whatever reason, it feels like they may be a really interesting fit, I'm going to ask questions that push on that gap, that would reveal things that might get in their way of being at a point where they can contribute their finest work. And so one body of questions I like to ask in that situation is the if not for question. Let's say someone's been with a company that's bigger and more sophisticated and more mature than ours. And yet they're telling me all these things they've done. What I have to understand is what about what they've done was connected to, and more importantly, dependent on a body of resources or realities that are very different in that mature company than we have in ours. So I'll ask questions like, okay, great. Tell me more about that program. Tell me what enabled it. And they'll tell me, I had this research. I had this legal team. I had bloop, bloop, bloop. You know, they go through it. And then I'll say, all right, now I want you to go back to that time and imagine leading and still being responsible for that initiative without X, Y, and Z. How would you have done it? And it reveals a lot. Right? Some people have been in mature businesses for so long, they don't even think about not having access to resources, which would make them a very difficult fit with an earlier stage or hypergrowth company. But there are others who pause and reflect and they are, okay, if I wouldn't have had this body of research, if I didn't have this team, a lot of times it has to do with just access to humans, like whole teams of people who do something that makes sense in a 50-year-old, $50 billion company that obviously the same construct does not exist in a hypergrowth earlier stage company, even if it's mature in its own way. So I love that body of questioning. It's a body of questioning. It's not one question because I have to ask about the initiative. I have to ask about what enabled it. And then I have to challenge them to envision that those resources were less or missing. And then ask, how would you have done it? And then a discussion ensues. How entrepreneurial are they? How resourceful can they be? Even in those cases, it doesn't mean it's a hire, no hire. It just makes me think, what does this person need to be as successful or more in my company as they were in the other? And is that even possible? And I have used that body of questioning to eliminate candidates from the process before, not because they were amazing, because I knew they weren't going to have access to what they were accustomed to being amazing. And there are other times where I'm like, what they're doing is what we need. We don't have everything they need. I need to budget for and plan for these additional resources in order for that person to bring their magic to the company that we need. So it's a different outcome.
How tempting is it, given all of the diversity of experience that you've had at some of these places, and then going to AG1, where the scope of revenue responsibility, if you were, is much smaller? How tempting is it? They only sell on AG1.com or whatever it is. It's all direct. They're not on Amazon. It's one product. It's always been one product. You're telling stories about how you're depackaging, repackaging, franchise models, like all of this complexity. Doesn't the builder in you sometimes just get, like, doesn't the energy that you have sometimes just want to go, like, build? Do you have to fight off that temptation to go do more when, interestingly, the core of what has made this business specifically great is doing less?
I mean, there were times early on where I thought some of that muscle of multiple levers existing in a business and bringing it to life might have been smart, fast follows for joining AG1. But then I'm as strong of a learner as I am a leader. And I learned a lot that I didn't appreciate as an AG1 customer about the power of that simplicity and focus and how the company had been rewarded for that focus. And it doesn't mean we won't ever have a few other products. The reality is we likely will. And it doesn't mean we won't be sold in a few other places. The reality is we probably will. But still, even if we had several more products and were sold in several more places, we're still the most extreme version of a focused business you could possibly find. And so I quickly learned the power of that focus and actually the brand positioning and the trust that comes from, if something is good for you and synergistic and can go in this, our whole positioning is one step, right? Instead of taking 30 pills and powders, 10 pills and powders that are hard to keep up with and difficult to know if you're doing it right and don't know if you can trust it and bad for the planet because of all those bottles, all that's in one step. The sheer core of our model is we make something that's very complicated in one step so that it is very easy for the customer. And so the idea of just throwing on a several extra SKUs and being in a lot of places actually flies in the face of the DNA of the business, of the differentiation of the business. And it flies in the face of the science of the product. Because our studies show, and we're one of the few companies that do scientific research on the finished product instead of just research on established individual ingredients, prove the synergy of the ingredients together. And if Chris had started this company on retail shelves, part of the retail game on shelf is you need multiple SKUs for a facing block to have more visual prominence. So of course a company's going to try to sell you five things because they need 5 feet of shelf space, right? They need max shelf space. But the reality is you're probably only buying 10% of those as a majority. There's a core, and then there's a long tail of things that help with attention and innovation and shelf space. We were D2C from the beginning. So we didn't have that non-customer serving reason to sell things in separate parts. It was in the customer's interest for efficacy of the product and simplicity of the routine, and therefore consistency, habit, and impact to have it be just one step. And again, there may be a few other things that are also one step in the future, but I will tell you, we have been rewarded for our focus. And while yes, this company is smaller, and certainly when I joined was, than the other businesses I've run, it's bigger than most people think. And that is because of that focus. And it's kind of like, I don't know, I have fun with it. You think about when you go into some of these restaurants or diners and the menu is like 30 pages long. And the first reaction is, oh my gosh, this place cannot be good at anything. If they're doing this many things, we have been doing one thing for 14 years. We have iterated AG1 52 times, making the ingredients better, adding ingredients, using new research to improve the formula, and iteration 53, we just keep making it better, like the iPhone for customers. And there's real moat in that. There's real differentiation in that. And being able to do that at scale, naturally, making it taste good with no sugars, no sweeteners. I mean, it's an art and a science to blend this many whole food ingredients and have it be as tasty as it is for people to drink it every day, for millions of people over time to have consumed it every day and to have their health be so positively impacted.
If folks are listening, drinkag1.com.
Drinkag1.com.
That's where you get it?
That's it. The only place you can buy it and subscribe is drinkag1.com.
Last question I ask every guest. When you hear the word grit, what do you think of?
My answer was my mom. Yeah, my mom.
Kat, I appreciate you doing this. Thank you.
My pleasure.
That's it. Thanks for tuning in. Feel free to come back every Monday morning to listen to a new guest or go back into the archives when we've done more than 100 episodes. This podcast is a Kleiner Perkins production, and the episode was edited by Eric Johnson from Lightning Pod. Thank you all.